This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Movies about musicians have a long legacy on the screen. They take us behind the songs and give us a backstage pass to the drama and heartbreak of life on the road. And they also let us live out our own fantasies of what life would be like if we, too, were famous musicians. Today is a special five-year anniversary edition of Movies on the Radio. Wow. We are 5 years old,
wow,
this show.
Happy anniversary.
Happy
to
anniversary
us.
To you, and thanks so much. We'll be thanking
you
and telling you how great you are for the entire hour.
Oh.
And playing clips from movies from listeners, picks from listeners about their favorite movie musics. Music Movies. Laura Boys is film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art and curator of the Movie Diva series at the Carolina Theater, and Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
To be here.
This is going to be a happy anniversary.
Thank you.
This is
perfect.
Fun. So let's start. Let's dig in and show them why this has survived for 5 years. And we'll start right off with a film that has been remade four times. This is the fourth remake of this 1937 film.
My name is Jack Joe. I'm calling from Durham, North Carolina, and the film about musicians that I want to talk about is the newest version of A Star is Born, starring Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga. I think this starts from the trailer. The initial trailer that, you know, came out last summer or whatever, with just like that vocal run from the song The Shallow. Can't imagine anything that could be like better for like a trailer, just been just like pure emotion right there. And then just watching the movie in October when it came out, I was just kind of giddy the entire time. That first hour or so, in particular the first half, is just so big. The emotions are just so pure.
Like almost every single person that I've come in contact with in the music industry has told me that my nose is too big and that I won't make it.
Your nose is beautiful. You showing me your nose right now?
Yeah.
You don't have to show it to me. I've been looking at it all night.
Oh, come on.
Oh, I'm going to
no,
be thinking about your nose for very
you're
long.
You're full of
I'm not full of
yeah,
I'm telling you,
you
the truth.
Yeah, you're full of
Can I touch your nose?
Oh, my gosh.
Let me just touch it for a second.
Sam Elliott, Dave Chappelle, these amazing supporting roles. And great music, an amazing soundtrack in both halves, even in the second half where Lady Gaga's character goes all pop and, you know, starts singing about, like, butts and jeans. Like, it's just, it's amazing.
Star is Born, starring Lady Gaga, Sam Elliott, and Dave Chappelle. By the way, we could not get the soundtrack, so that is actually Marcia Gordon singing that riff from the song.
Thank you for letting me live out my singing on the air fantasy. I appreciate it.
He's been wanting to sing that. So let's talk about this. Well, let's talk about the legacy of this film, Laura, first.
Well, it actually didn't start in 1937 with the Janet Gaynor version, but there's an even earlier version called What Price Hollywood with Constance Bennett that was a big influence on The Star is Born. And it's, you know, in each incarnation, it's a young woman who meets an older actor / musician, and he begins to mold her, and then she outgrows him. And so the conflict is whether they can resolve their personal relationship as the, you know, shifting stardom of each person affects everything in their lives.
And so much of this is such a star vehicle, right? Because it was Judy Garland and then Barbara Streisand, mm-hmm. and now it's kind of like every 20 or so years we were overdue. And so I think the casting with Lady Gaga was fantastic. I mean, I personally have a few qualms about the kind of narrative of the sacrificial love story and the kind of sellout that she becomes after all this authenticity in the beginning. But I think almost everyone I've talked to has so loved this film. And it's kind of interesting right now that we have Bohemian Rhapsody. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a kind of little moment of these music movies being in the theaters and being pretty successful.
But don't you think the star vehicle part of it is the most critical? In other words, this is the story we believe about these super pop stars in their moment, the Judy Garland, the Barbra Streisands. And so we'd like to see that represented on the stage, on the film, on the screen with them.
Yeah, that becoming, which is kind of inevitable, because this is actually a film that would be hard for me to imagine doing with somebody who we didn't know was already a superstar. So that's kind of interesting to think about, just in terms of the way this is brokering on the kind of celebrity of an existing star.
And I thought actually one of the smartest things was that their conflict comes when she becomes more poppy, and that's something that he can't relate to.
Right.
I thought that was really a good way of sort of segueing, if you will.
Let us segue to now a film that has gained cult status over the years.
My movie selection is The Commitments. And the reason I love The Commitments is the way it portrayed a struggling band, the issues they had. I thought the chemistry between the band members was really good, and the music selections they had were just fantastic. And it was a really enjoyable film with a tremendous soundtrack.
Hello, Dublin! Tickets to Wilson Pickett tonight, no? You're supposed to come and see us, you know? I'm serious, only our manager f***ed up. Yeah! We'd like to do a Pickett song now. Hope you like it. Hit it.
Exactly it, Jimmy. Like, EG Records, we're a small label, but we're good because we care, you know what I mean? Like, there'll be no money up front, but we'll pay for an engineer and studio time for a day.
That sounds brilliant.
I'm gonna wait till the midnight hour. That's when my love comes tumbling down. I'm gonna wait till the midnight hour.
From the 1991 musical The Commitments, a film based on a novel by the same name by writer Roddy Doyle. What do you think?
Yeah, so this is a film about working class kids in Dublin putting this band together. And interestingly enough, as with A Star Is Born, which at first they seem to have nothing in common, but I think the story that the audience loves so much is of seeing a character go from having a dream, right, to realizing the dream. And so in the case of The Commitments, it's very much that same idea. And I just remember thinking it was so much fun. I haven't seen it since it came out, but it was so much fun to watch. And I also wanted to mention that the director of this film, Alan Parker, also directed Fame, which when I was growing up was absolutely one of my favorite imaginings of song and dance in this New York performing arts school. So he's got this great tradition. I think he might have also done something with Pink Floyd.
It is Movies on the Radio today on The State of Things. Marcia Gordon and Laura Boies. Laura?
So I loved this movie so much when it came out, I ran right out and bought the cassette tape, which I played over and over and over again. And this film reminds me of the Blues Brothers and the fact that it's a love letter to this kind of soul music, that maybe you can't be those authentic bands, but you can be as close as possible to reproducing their sound.
Well, here's a pick from one of our North Carolina musicians.
Hi, this is Joe Kwan with the Avett Brothers. I'm calling you from a hotel room in Denver, Colorado, and my movie pick is Shine. It was a movie that I watched growing up as a classical cellist, and I related to it closely. It's obviously not so much of the darkness of the film and the mental instability that the main character goes through, but the obsession that he takes towards the Rachmaninoff piano concerto, I believe it was number 3, and the scenes where he is actually air practicing the piano, I remember as a young kid being a very serious scene, but one that I related to just being from the classical world.
Rachmaninoff, are you sure?
Kind of. I'm never really sure about anything, Mr. Pax.
Well, no one's ever been mad enough to attempt the Rack 3.
Am I mad enough, Professor? Am I?
Think of it as two separate melodies jousting for supremacy. The hands, giants, 10 fingers each. performing's a risk, you know. No safety net. Make no mistake, David. It's dangerous. People get hurt.
From the 1996 film Shine, Joe Kwan of the Avid Brothers picked that as his favorite.
This, of course, was an Oscar-winning role for Jeffrey Rush, which brought him out of Australian obscurity into mainstream film. And it's also a film about conflict with his father, which goes all the way back to the jazz singer, because your father never wants you to become a musician. So
yeah, well, and of course, there's also mental illness in this. And this is one of those, it's not just a rise and fall story from what I remember, but it's really about kind of conquering these other obstacles that could get in the way of you being successful and recognized for your success in a kind of mainstream context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I love the geekiness of it. I mean, I actually like those instructions. Think of it as two competing melodies, you know, that sort of thing. I may have said this before, but with the Marx Brothers movies, which I loved, one of my favorite moments was when Harpo played, and later when I read his autobiography, I learned that he actually, that was his favorite moment, and that when they were filming him doing that, he was playing, and he was so totally into it. And you could see that.
Yes.
I just sort of love watching a musician or an artist actually be in the moment.
Yeah.
Since Laura brought up the jazz singer, if I could very quickly say that this is a 1927 film that was really important in terms of the history of sound technology, a Warner Brothers film with Al Jolson. And it is about a young man who wants to be a musician. His father disapproves. And so there's always that story, as Laura alluded to, of somebody doing something in defiance of parental expectations, social expectations. And then when they succeed in doing so,
because music is rebellion.
That's right.
Movies on the Radio with Laura Boys and Marcia Gordon continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today we're celebrating our fifth anniversary for Movies on the Radio. This is so exciting. And to do that, we're, for no particular reason, having nothing to do with 5 years or the show, we're looking at your favorite movies about music with Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys and your picks for musician movies. I don't know, they both have M's and I can't get through it. Laura Boys, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art and curator of the Movie Diva series at the Carolina Theater. Marcia is a film professor at North Carolina State University, and here's our next pick.
Hi, my name is Jane Cousins. I'm calling from Raleigh, North Carolina, and my favorite film about musicians is the film Once. I love this movie because it feels truly genuine about its depiction of musicians and their love of music, even though it was shot on a minimal budget and it definitely doesn't have the same big musical effects like a lot of mainstream movies do. This little Irish film still feels so big in the way it knows about musicians and their love of music and their passion for it. It makes me feel more wonderful that it was all written by both of the main actors who are the characters. My favorite scene is when they play for the first time in the piano store.
Falling slowly, eyes that know it, and I can't go back. And moves that take me and erase me.
No big special effects. It's just a piano and a guitar and them connecting over music. It makes my heart and my eyes swell all at the same time.
Take this sinking boat and port it home. We've still got time.
That's a clip from the 2007 film Once on the State of Things.
I know many people that love this movie so much. Go to see Glenn Hansard when he performs. Went to see the Broadway version of it with its cast. And I'm the softest, most sentimental person in the world. But there was just something about this movie that I just did not connect with it. And I totally respect everyone's love for it. I do not denigrate that at all.
Even though no pianos were harmed in the
even
production
though no
of this
pianos
film.
Were harmed, there was just something about
it. No slasher scene, no jump scares.
No.
And it's funny because I would say my tastes run to the darker and the more cynical.
Oh, really?
And I found this movie to be so charming and sweet and romantic, and I really...
It's
funny that we have flipped on this one. We'll have to investigate this further.
Do either of you think that there's something, because obviously there's a dark undertone that somehow came through.
Right.
Do you think that this sort of fits the type, or does this work against the type of music films that are lots of rags to riches, lots of becoming, that sort of thing, lots of authenticity? Is it authentic or not? I mean, those are all some of the themes that mark these movies. Is this movie counter to that in any way, or maybe it's same?
They're very unassuming people.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's part of it, and I think that's what the caller was getting at, which I like, which is you look at a film like A Star Is Born, and it's all about this kind of big level production, capital S stardom, and this is about, you know, two people encountering each other and kind of sharing this passion and this talent. And so it just, it's a very different scale.
Because it's actually really hard to convey on film that making music is pleasurable. And you don't need to have an audience. You don't need to be successful. The process of making the movie, the music somehow is an end in itself. And that's one thing that this movie, I think, does really well.
But in order to convey that through Hollywood, I have to say, it felt like there was only piano and guitar, but there were cellos, there were viola. I mean, it started out simple. But I'm saying, in order to make you feel the power of the moment, one needed to add the orchestra. And they did, and it was a fine film. We've got actually a husband and wife team. We'll take them one at a time now from the rocker duo Birds of Avalon. Raleigh-based Birds and Avalon members Chidi Kumar and Paul Seiler both shared their favorites. Let's start with Chidi and her favorite.
Hey, this is Chidi Kumar. I'm the chef and co-owner of Garland and the guitar player for Birds of Avalon, calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. And my pick for favorite music movie is Neil Young and Crazy Horse's Rust Never Sleeps. I love this movie for not only the music, but just the little bits of humor and, like, all the little moments, the set design of these gigantic Fender amps, which they took sort of a macho rock cliche and made it hilarious by making themselves look super tiny. I love the little nods to Devo. The name of the movie actually comes from a line that Devo was always using, and they were working on a commercial for Rust-Oleum, and Rust Never Sleeps was something that they kept repeating over and over, and Neil Young borrowed that for his title. I don't know. There's just all of this weird non sequitur stuff inserted into a concert by four guys in, you know, flannel shirts, and Neil Young wearing all white, being strong and vulnerable all at the same time. Beautiful guitar playing, great vocal harmonies, and excellent songs.
Aurora Borealis, the icy sky at night, paddles cut the water in a long and hurried flight. From the white man to the fields of green. And the home.
That's Chidi Kumar, chef and rocker, talking about Rust Never Sleeps, a 1979 concert film covering performances from Neil Young and Crazy Horse.
I never knew there was a connection between Neil Young and Devo, so I'm very happy to
learn
that.
There you go, and they're brought together by Rust-Oleum.
And Neil Young apparently also directed this film and just used a fake name on the title sequence. I've actually never seen this film, and what's kind of interesting about that to me is that this gets at something about, as we transition to documentaries, which I believe are doing right now for a little while, which is that a film like this, you know, its market is Neil Young fans, right? So it's kind of interesting to think about the way some music documentaries can have a wider kind of reach because it's not simply about a musician, a concert, a recording session, or whatever. But this is one of those cases where it's hard for me to imagine someone seeking this out or seeing this unless they're a Neil Young fan.
It's proto MTV, right?
Yes.
79.
That's right.
Very good point.
Yeah, and it's true. And I don't know how it did. Do you know how it did?
I have no idea. I can't imagine it was a huge success, but that's I could be completely wrong about that.
Good for sure. Well, the other thing is, right around this time, you had rock stars, big stars, wanting to make deeper forays into film. I mean, you've got in 1984, Paul McCartney does Give My Regards to Broad Street, a film that didn't do well. The soundtrack did. Paul Simon in 1980, One Trick Pony, again. These are both feature films done by big stars. They seem to want to break into film.
There's a lot. I think this really starts in the 60s, but as we escalate in the 70s and 80s of musicians realizing that there's like this whole other world you can conquer if you can just get into a movie theater. And so, and some of these are vanity projects and they're, you know, funded by the musician, which is always somewhat questionable. And others, I think, are more interesting.
Well, I like to think about one of the great geniuses, I think, of music, which is David Byrne, and Stop Making Sense, which is a completely, you know, awesome music documentary. But then he also made a fiction film.
What was that called?
We have a staff of thousands looking that up right now.
But
Road to Nowhere was in that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a look at yet another, now as long as we're talking about documentaries,
yes.
Chidi Kumar's husband and bandmate, Paul Seiler.
Hi, my name is Paul Seiler, and I'm in a band called Birds of Avalon, along with my wife, Chidi. We also have a music venue in downtown Raleigh called Kings, also one called Neptunes, which is below Kings. My favorite movie, and that was involved with a music aspect, is called Gimme Shelter. It tells the trials and tribulations of the 1969 Rolling Stones tour that ends horrifically in Altamont, California.
Everybody seems to be ready. Are you ready? For the first time in 3 years, the greatest rock and roll band in the world, the Rolling Stones! The Rolling Stones!
This is Stefan Ponick, KSAN Radio, San Francisco. Well, the Rolling Stones tour of the United States is over. They wound it up with a free concert at the Altamont Speedway for more than 300,000 people. There were 4 births, 4 deaths, and an awful lot of scuffles reported. We received word that someone was stabbed to death in front of the stage by a member of the Hell's Angels.
Is there an officer or a policeman here? What happened here anyway?
Yeah, he pulled out a gun.
He did?
Yes, the Hell's Angels took the gun away from him. One of them has it now, he showed it to me. And they proceeded to put him down on the ground and start kicking him.
People get weird, and you need people like the Angels to keep people in line, but the Angels also, you know, you don't bust people in the head for nothing.
The entire concert is literally terrifying, and nobody would want to be within a mile of there. But it's gripping, and for somebody who was growing up loving music like this, you just wanted to see it, and you kind of can't take your eyes off the screen. One of the other best parts about the movie is that you get to see the Stones recording in Muscle Shoals, Alabama.
As from Gimme Shelter, Paul Seiler from the Birds of Avalon, one of his favorite films having to do with music and musicians.
This is such an interesting film. So this is a Maisel's Brothers film. They're some of the kind of pioneers of direct observational cinema. And this is such a layered, rich, complicated document of so much more than just a concert. Obviously, this turned into something much more tragic and much bigger. And it was interesting. I looked up the New York Times review of this film because I was curious how it was received at the time. And Vincent Canby, who wrote it, called it one of the most unpleasant, bleak, and depressing movies he had ever encountered. And he encouraged people to think about the ethics of making a film that you knew was going to end a certain way, right? So what I think, I disagree with that assessment, because I think what the Maisels do so brilliantly by showing, for example, some of the Stones, including Mick Jagger, in the editing room, looking at the footage, reliving what happened through the eyes
of... Being horrified.
Exactly. That it's really, I think it's a much smarter, I don't think Canby gave it the credit, but it does, there's this sense of doom intertwined with all this amazing music, and that's exactly... I think, an appropriate way to represent something like that.
And, of course, Altamont is considered, the epitaph for the whole 1960s.
The day the music died.
Exactly. So the fact that such a really smart filmmakers right. made this really intricate and layered film about it is really a treasure.
And we're there to witness also some of the planning of it. And so right. This is, if you have not seen this film, it's got four or five different kind of tracks that run through it. Right. And the music is only a small part of it, really.
Yeah, and compare it. And it has to be compared because the concert is compared, obviously, to Woodstock.
Right, throughout
the film. The film has to be compared to the film Woodstock, yeah. which is just a sort of let's throw this stuff and stay away from the brown acid and that's it, we're done.
Yeah.
Right? And that's Woodstock. And then this other film, which is a much deeper look at the entire industry.
Well, it's a self-reflexive moment, I think, in terms of filmmaking as well, and also in terms of just thinking about the state of kind of American youth culture at the time.
Yeah, yeah, and how things had changed very, very quickly. So there was a reference to the Stones in the Muscle Shoals recording studio in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. I get to pick one this because it's our anniversary.
This is a rare fifth anniversary treat.
Yes.
Rare fifth anniversary treat. Muscle Shoals, one of my favorite movies of all times because I knew what the Muscle Shoals music section was, the rhythm section was. I had no idea that they're these doughy white boys. Unbelievable. And that's only part of the story. It's that the white guys, doughy white guys, I mean, they don't even look like music. What does a musician look like? They don't look like it. And the whole story, not Rick Hall, who designed this place, who created it, his personal backstory, the story of this Muscle Shoals recording studio, and the greats, Aretha Franklin's whole career is revitalized as a result of this one day at Muscle Shoals and the people who went through it. It's an incredible... So I'll play one clip now. This is the one clip, one of many clips of these rare moments captured in this film.
I gets off the plane, Southern Airlines, and he had this long, tall white man, and we call him Peckerwoods.
I met Wilson Pickett, picked him up at the airport. He looked like, to me, a dangerous man.
He walked up like he'd known me for 500 years. Hey, Wilson, come on, we're gonna cut some good records. Boy, we're gonna really cut some records. Come on, Wilson, come on. I said, wait, I'm nervous, you know what I mean? Now, what does white man know about producing a Wilson Pickett?
And on the way to the studio, I'd look at him and he'd look at me and I could see it in his eyes. He was thinking, what am I doing with this cracker down here in Alabama?
We went through the cotton patch, people still picking cotton. I said, is that what I think it is? Yeah, wasn't it still picking cotton down here? You could see a studio from the cotton patch.
There it is, a clip from the 2007, no, it is not. We're talking about Muscle Shoals now, a 2013 documentary, Muscle Shoals, and we're talking about that today. Music on the radio today on the state of things. Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys.
And this also reminds me a little bit of 20 Feet from Stardom about how the music that you love is not a product solely of the headliner and that it's a much more complex experience.
Yeah, I felt like I learned so much from this documentary. That's the best thing, right? When you
right,
watch something,
yeah,
you think
yeah.
you know a little bit, but you're like, oh no, I didn't know anything.
Okay, let's start at the beginning and go through it all again.
Yeah, exactly. And not only that, but again, it's the behind the scenes look, and it's the what really makes a record. You know, the Wrecking Crew, what amazing Los Angeles group of studio musicians, but all of many backstories, including the land itself, which belonged
right.
to Native Americans, the story of race, the story of Rick Hall himself, all of those stories coming together. It was just way too much for one movie. Marcia, you chose a film that takes a deep look as well.
Yeah, so so I'm going to talk about a film called A Poem is a Naked Person, directed by Les Blank, one of the most interesting documentary filmmakers to my estimation. And it's easier to say in some ways what this film is not than what it is, because it is definitely not a conventional music documentary. It's not a concert film. It's not a making of an album film. It is an impressionistic experimental meditation kind of on time and place and spirit with a lot of music and a lot of Leon Russell.
A lot of Leon Russell. Let's listen.
Goodbye, Joe. We gotta go down the bayou.
A That's Leon Russell performing Jambalaya in the film A Poem is a Naked Person, Marsha Gordon's pick for favorite movie about musicians.
So you do, of course, get some concert footage. Because of rights issues, this film was very hard to see. It was shot over the course of several years in the 1970s, until a couple of years ago when Leon Russell finally agreed to allow its release. This is a film that he actually commissioned, so he paid Les Blank to make this film, which usually would make for something terrible, but Les Blank is not a filmmaker of any kind of conventions. So what he made was not only not entirely flattering, but also it was so much more than just a look at Russell and a kind of puff piece about him. And so some of the footage is in the studio, and there are drop-ins from some amazing musicians like George Jones.
Take me to your darkest room. Close every window, bolt every door. The very first moment I heard your voice, I'd be in darkness no more.
It's George Jones from the film A Poem is a Naked Person.
If you're not moved by that voice, I don't know what to say for you. But so this was shot largely in Oklahoma around Leon Russell's recording studio, but it also involves lots of kind of just the band hanging out. There's scorpions, there's snakes, there's murals. And then there's, Les Blank would get kind of distracted by talking to local people. And that's some of the best parts of this film.
Well, the first time I saw Leon, I liked to come unglued because he had long hair and I wasn't used to it.
What do you think about long hair now?
I love it. My husband's growing it and I'm falling in love with him again because he's got long hair.
That's from a poem, isn't
it? I think that's everybody's their own business.
There you go. Thank you.
That's right. So I love this film because on the one hand, you do get a glimpse of Leon Russell, the musician. You get lots of beautiful music, but it's so textured. It's so complicated, and it's a time capsule. And so I just think it's a fantastic film, period.
Marsha Gordon, Laura Boys. Laura, you can talk about this when we come back. We'll take
Okey-doke.
A break, and we'll talk more about this and other films on the state of things when we look at musicians in the movies when we come back. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio with the special five-year anniversary of Movies on the Radio. Look for the box set this Christmas. This is pretty exciting. We're celebrating with an episode that takes you behind the scenes of your favorite movies about musicians. Marsha Gordon, Laura Boys. Laura, of course, the film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art and curator of the Movie Divas series at the Carolina Theater. Marsha Gordon, a film professor at North Carolina State. And we're talking about the film that that Marsha picked, a poem is like a naked person.
Is a naked person.
Like.
And I just wanted to say very briefly that Les Blank loved regional styles of music. He made many, many documentaries that were Valentines to various regional styles, and this clearly kind of fits into that.
Yeah.
Let's move on.
Hey, I'm Sam Gerwick calling from Raleigh, North Carolina, and my favorite music film is Walk Hard: The Dewey Cox Story. I think it does a great job at finding the humor in the music industry.
20 years, not once have you thrown a woman my way. You don't think we like cheating on our wives too?
And you never once paid for drugs.
Not once. You pay that chimp more than you pay us. I had to borrow from the chimp to get a mortgage on my house.
And those stupid Siamese glass cats you get us every year for Christmas. I don't want any more Siamese glass cats.
The Siamese cat is a symbol of nobility in ancient Egypt.
And you never paid for drugs.
Not once. You slept with my wife.
You slept with me too. And I've had confused feelings about that for 10 years now.
And you never once paid for drugs.
Not once.
I really like how John C. Reilly shows off his incredible acting skills, which I think are underrated, and also his talent as a singer. I don't think he wrote the music, but he definitely performed it. And I always like that in a music movie.
How y'all doing? My name's Dewey Cox. Well, it looks like I got some proving myself to do.
Walk hard
From the 2007 comedy Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story, directed by Jake, is that Cassidy? Cassidy? I don't know. I don't know. He's never directed me in a film.
Not yet.
So I haven't seen this movie, but I saw the trailer and I am all in. It clearly has a great love for this rags to riches arc that we've talked about over and over again. And I remember that Walk the Line about Johnny Cash and Ray about Ray Charles came out about the same time. And they were the same movie.
Yeah.
They just had the same plot, you know, the rise, and then the fall that just seemed to take forever.
And,
so,
and I actually didn't see this film either, but it is a parody, right?
Yes.
Right, so,
right.
So it's, I mean, and that
just
would,
the fact that you asked that, yeah. I think, is really.
I mean, my point being that the stories that you get in, like, the Johnny Cash, Ray Charles, that right. conventional rise and fall narrative. I mean, frankly, I find those biopics to be pretty tedious and awful right. by and large. Right. Like, I'm not charmed by them really at all, and so I kind of, you know, I haven't seen this, but that clearly is mocking the conventions of the
no, and I think rock mockumentaries are actually more exquisite than any of the others because they contain all of that, and it's, you know, because I mean, at least the Back to the Ruddles that Monty Python did, and Spinal Tap.
Let's please talk about Spinal Tap. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about your favorite. Here's Laura Boy's pick. That's it.
Well, you know what movie that is. That's
name,
all you need is
name
one
that tune
chord.
One, note,
yes.
one chord. It's so, an F. It's an F. F9 actually.
Oh, it
is an
no,
F9.
I had
yeah.
no idea.
Yeah, but here's the thing that makes the sound. It's not the addition of the ninth tone in the F chord. That by itself was pretty cool. George did that. George Martin slammed a piano chord of Little or No Reputation in the recording. So you'll never do that thing live unless you have George Martin.
Wow, I had no idea. Thank you, Frank.
That's
we're getting deep
is.
In the weeds that, of nerddom here over
is
this movie.
The only thing I care about in this movie.
So, you know, I was at a critical age when I saw this, 11 years old. I love the Beatles so, so much.
We should probably say the title.
Hard Day's Night. Hard Day's Night. Love the Beatles so, so much. And this movie completely played into all of my tween fantasies about what it would be like to hang out with the Beatles and be their friend, because at 11 years old, I did not progress any farther than that. And there's a documentary called Good Old Frida about their secretary
Such
the whole
a great
time,
doc,
which
yeah.
is a great documentary. And I must have read something about her when I was 11 years old, because my fantasy was to be the Beatles' secretary.
You wanted to be Frida.
When that's I was great. A kid. Is that not the most
yeah.
pathetic thing
well, that's
you've
great.
Ever
wanted,
heard in
I wanted
your
to
life.
Be Paul. So there you go. That's how that. And seeing their faces, because I was 11 too, and I saw it in the theater, and just seeing their faces bigger than life.
It was so exciting. And for some reason, the whole energy of Richard Lester's movie, the black and white photography, you know, they were so quippy and irreverent. And I recently watched this documentary that comes from British Film Institute, in which Michael Caine is talking about the swinging 60s in London, filtered through his experience. And while we look at the Beatles' music as being a generational thing, that we were repudiating the boring music of our parents, for the British, it was a class thing. It was the first time that the working class became a cultural powerhouse against the aristocracy. And that's what it meant to
and
them.
They had the right to be cheeky.
Yes.
Tell me, how did you find America?
Turn left to Greenland.
No, actually, we're just good friends.
Has success changed your life?
Yes.
Are you a mod or a rocker?
No, I'm a mocker.
There you go, Hard Day's Night.
Well, and what you hear, the other thing about this film is that in addition to being super stylish, it's so playful and so gently self-mocking that, you know, it doesn't have a sense of kind of arch irony or any, you know, that kind of tone to it, but it's so pleasurable and it's so aware of like what Beatlemania is.
And it's not a rags to riches
right.
and to rags thing, because it's just a snapshot of their lives over 36 hours or whatever. And so there's no unhappiness in it.
I was actually curious to see how this was received. So I looked at the New York Times review of it. Bosley Crowther, who my students know very well because I talk about him all the time. He's the very curmudgeonly New York Times reviewer. He loved this movie.
Really?
That's a sign of what a crowd pleaser.
And put together quickly, because it was like, these guys are famous and they're not going to be famous long. Let's make the movie now. And they did.
I mean,
it took, I think, less time to make it than the 36 hours it represented the movie. Let us move on. Let us move on, shall we, to the next listener, Amazing Grace.
This is Godfrey Cheshire. I'm a film critic originally from Raleigh, based in New York City, where I'm calling from now. And I'm here to talk about Amazing Grace, which is a truly amazing film about Aretha Franklin recording a gospel album in 1972. It was a documentary shot at that time, but it's been 46 years to take it to come out. That's a kind of a remarkable story in itself. Apparently, there were technical problems originally, and then she didn't want it to come out for whatever reasons, and it was not until after her death that for technical and legal reasons it was able to come out. And so now it is playing in New York City in one run that will probably go for some time. And it's hoped that there will be a distributor to distribute it around the country soon. But I say this as somebody who's not a really big soul music fan or Aretha fan, although I do like her, but I was just astonished at how great this film is. It is certainly one of the 10 best concert films of all times. And the recording she made at this time became her best-selling album ever and the best-selling live gospel album of all time.
I say with pride that Aretha is not only my daughter. Aretha is just a stone singer.
Aretha performing at the New Bethel Baptist Church in Watts, Los Angeles in 1972 from the film Amazing Grace.
I want to see this so badly. I hope it comes to the Triangle.
I know. And Godfrey, in his many, many years of reviewing for The Spectator and The Independent, always gets to see this stuff in New York before we get to see it.
Well, limited release. That's the problem with this film.
Gives
right?
us something to look forward to. But this, as with the Leon Russell film, like the legal issues,
right.
That's the thing when you're dealing with musicians, just write your contracts well.
Yes. Mm. And it's playing at Film Forum in New York right now. And I saw on their website, every screening was completely sold out, right. And they were having a waiting list for people to come
gosh.
And see it. Yeah.
Great stuff. Let's move on now. Another North Carolina musician.
Hi, my name is Tift Merritt. I'm a musician. I'm calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. I love the film Tender Mercies with Robert Duvall. Robert Duvall plays Mac, a country singer who has become an alcoholic and sort of lost everything. And he ends up running a motel. And through relationships with fans and his ex-wife, who is a famous singer, and his relationship to music, you kind of see him redefine meaning in his life in a much truer way.
They broke even on all our records, but even so, they're not going to record us with our own songs.
Yeah. It's a dirty business, so maybe it's the best thing that can happen to you for now. The world isn't going to come to an end, I tell you.
We heard last week that they'd record us if we used two of your songs.
I gave my permission. I told you that.
Yeah, but it's not just your songs. They want you to sing them.
I'll tell you what. I ain't promised nothing, you understand. I'll give it a try. Give me a couple of days to think it over.
Thank you.
Hey, mister. Were you really Max Sledge?
Yes, ma'am, I guess I was.
It really impacts me because I'm a musician. I've lived on the road. I know that strangers cannot fill your life with what family can.
There is Grammy-nominated artist Tift Merritt with one of her favorite films about musicians, the 1983 film Tender Mercies.
This was a film that made Robert Duvall a leading man. He'd been a supporting actor for so long, but he just inhabited this character so powerfully, it really changed his career.
Well, and he won the Best Actor Academy Award, and I don't know what on earth possessed me to do this, but I watched a YouTube video of him getting that award, and Dolly Parton is the one who hands it to him, and she's
funny.
So excited. She has to come up again to hug him. I mean, this was a big moment, I think, for country music, too, in terms of its representation on the screen, and so I kind of like that this film is not the rise and fall structure. You're kind of starting after the fall.
You're starting after the fall,
and looking at how someone's lived their life and what they're going to do to keep on living it, maybe not doing what they did before, making the same mistakes.
We just talked about this kind of cross pollination, the idea that this was country music on the rise. That's also the theme of country music, so it really played well. If you're trying to promote country music, this film is it, right? Mm-hmm. It's the theme, it's the music, and it's the character. All in One, Movies on the Radio. Today we're talking about your favorite musician films today on The State of Things. Marcia Gordon, Laura Boys are with me. Let's go to the phones now because Jessica is on the line and wants to talk about a film that is a favorite of hers. Hello, Jessica.
Hi. I was just thinking about the film 8 Mile from 2002, and it's, played by actor Eminem and has a lot of biographical elements from his life, and I love it because it really kind of illustrates that struggle that people have in the beginning of, balancing, being able to work and live and the struggle of being creative. And also I love that the film doesn't have that rise and fall structure, the part of the film plot is around this battle that happens, and even after he wins the battle, he goes out into the parking lot and then has to go to work right after that. So it doesn't have this kind of stardom element to it, but has that creativity. So.
Thanks, Jessica. The film 8 Mile, huh?
Yeah, and I saw this when it came out and not since then, so it's not super fresh in my memory. But, it's interesting when you have these, obviously, Eminem's career was a music career and then tried to, and I don't know what happened exactly. It seemed like he was going in a more actorly direction. I believe that he has disappeared. I could be wrong about that. But to kind of broker that celebrity by moving into this other way. And one way to do that is through the documentary form and another is through fiction, or in this case, semi-fictional filmmaking. And I do remember that this was kind of a little bit of a sensation when it came out.
So. I have time for one more.
Hi, my name is Steve Edwards, and I'm from Cary, North Carolina. My selection this week is The Glenn Miller Story. The Glenn Miller Story stars Jimmy Stewart and June Allison in one of three husband and wife movies they made in the 50s. It covers Glenn Miller's life from probably sometime in the 30s through his death in 1945. I fell in love with the movie when my parents took me to see it, and the music just captivated me. As a result of my love for the Glenn Miller music, I've always been in pursuit of little historical facts that have left me in a position to actually visit places in England where Glenn Miller performed, one of which was an air base called Poddington, where my dad was actually stationed and saw Glenn Miller play. Because of my love for Glenn Miller's music, I now carry around with me on my iPhone every known recording Glenn Miller ever made.
There's Steve talking about the Glenn Miller Story in 1954.
Wow. Wow. That's really impressive.
Also, the first film, I think, that predated, it came before the 60s in their entire collection today.
Yeah, but there were a lot of biopics of people that we would now consider to be authors of the Great American Songbook. Yeah. Or, and certainly these big bands appeared in films as well, usually as... just like a musical interlude kind of thing.
Well, and this is an interesting film because it's kind of nostalgia for the recent past, right?
Right.
So
he'd been dead for 10 years.
About 10 years. Right. And Jimmy Stewart plays him, by the way. And there's some interesting cameos in this film, including Gene Krupa, Louis Armstrong. And so, this kind of satisfies...
Truth to be told, were much more swinging musicians than Glenn Miller.
Oh, yeah. That gave him a little cred, having them in the film, for sure.
How to organize the band and get everybody on the train. That has a lot to do with it. Hey, 5 years. Congratulations. What a pleasure.
Thank you for putting up with us. Thank you, Frank. Laura Boyce, Marcy Gordon. I keep asking every week,
aren't you getting bored with this?
We love it. It's getting better by the minute. By the way, Laura's screening the 1979 film, Being There on January 11th, part of her North Carolina Museum of Art film series in Raleigh. And you can find out more about all of this stuff at stateofthings.org, a program produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. I don't have much time left. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.